Hello?
Right, we're going back to 2008, and it's under Thero International, and I was trying to find people to participate with me in inspirational speaking, people who were building up in the United States a reputation for being influential, to say the very least. And I've been contacted by Sharon Abbott, who was creating her own reality, and this was back in that time. And now she's involved in something really exciting for young kids who are disadvantaged in the States. And anyway, let's go and find out what it's all about. So, on the telephone from her home in California is Sharon Abbott. And Sharon, first of all, it's nice to talk with you again.
Same here, Ben.
I was listening to our podcast that we made just as the recession was beginning to take its hold here in the European countries. It was on the 9th of July, and I think the year was 2007.
Either 7 or 8, but it has been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah. It's interesting because I've gone back to that to just listen to it before we spoke tonight. Just basically to see how we both were talking and the sort of things that were of importance to us, you know. Obviously, the recession has been biting away. What happened for me was the radio company that I work for, they went to the wall. Not strictly true, actually. They are part of it was international, and it's a Spanish parent company. And rather than sort out maybe things that needed sorting out, they thought the quickest and most expedient way to solve a problem was to get rid of the people that were probably working as well as anybody else. But that's recession. And there's a lot of people have suffered fairly similar fates over the last few years.
You know, that's so typical when there's a financial challenge. You just start thinking companies lob people off. And they don't even realize that that's the one thing that they should not do. You know, I've seen that. There's a company here close to Monterey called the Institute of HeartMath, and they have interviewed every company and tracked their financial record. Not one company ever became more profitable for laying people off since 2003.
I think that says it all, doesn't it?
It does. Well, it does. And then the people who are left there become disgruntled employees. They don't work as efficiently, and the company suffers even more.
Well, ours was a massive broadcaster throughout Spain, and we just had two stations which were international. We used the English language. And I was beginning to get people like yourself to make the connections across from the other side of the Atlantic, because I knew things were beginning to change. I knew things were beginning to be difficult for lots of people, and I knew that, you know, you've got to look for different ideas, you've got to look for different ways to solve your problems. And it was almost as if really they just didn't want to become part of really the way that was. Anyway, I don't think at that time you had started your current venture. Would that be right? The Ultimate Business University hadn't started then, had it?
No, in 2000 is when the idea first came about. And then, you know, that in 1998, my little brother ended up with colon cancer in the hospital in Dallas, infected him with HIV. So it really started about 2000.
Oh, okay. So in actual fact, it had well started by then.
It had, but it was more of a concept. And up until the last 5 years, so I would say somewhere around 2009, 2010, is when I realized that it was something that I could do. And that's about the time that people started rallying around, and it became more of a concept rather than, you know, someday this wish list that might take place.
But it certainly was in line with what you were trying to say with our first conversation, when you were saying that really, you know, it's time for people to take care of their own destiny, if you like. And it's quite strange because probably by speaking to yourself and Jim Bouchard and various other people, I started to make these podcasts and increase the net of the people that I speak with. Radio in itself has gone very fragile in that, like I see in the States as well, a lot of companies really, they just want to play a loop of music now, and they don't really want to spend, right, you know, a lot of money with a telephone and a professional presenter. And I think, unfortunately, you know, the numbers of stations that really heavily invest in trying to make a program that's quite intellectual, even though it might be entertainment, I think they seem to be far and few between, don't they?
Well, they are. But then on the other hand, like, you've embraced the podcasting, which means you have more control over your content, the time that you work, you can be a lot more flexible, and you can reach a much broader audience with the podcast. So in a way, it kind of works to your benefit, and that goes along with the line, you know, create your own reality. When something happens, you know, a lot of people fold, but instead of folding, you figure out the best solution that works for you at the moment, but realizing that's not the final answer, because we can always, you know, try this, it doesn't work, try that, and then you just keep moving forward.
Yeah. Okay, well, look, what I did pick up by looking at what we first spoke about, by going back and revisiting the podcast, which again is one very, very quick advantage of having podcasts. You can go back and maybe make comparisons and see whether or not you've made any progress. And I think I might not have told you, maybe during our first chat, that I had been heavily involved in youth unemployment schemes in the UK. You know, I was in teaching, even though obviously I have a love of broadcasting and various other things. That was part of a job that I did. And it looks to me as if there's got to be some sort of similarities between what I was doing and what you are developing in the respect of taking school. And I see when you spoke to Clancy Tucker in Australia, he asked you the question about developing a school for kids at risk. Now, would you say that there's much of a difference between kids at risk and just kids who are out of work in general, finding life difficult, who have to be found something worthwhile to do?
There's a big difference, Vince. What I'm targeting, and of course there's many different needs for youth under 21, but in the United States we have 200,000 children living on the street without an adult to protect them or provide for them. That's my target. So there are kids, of course, who are under 18 who need a job. There's kids under 21 who need a job, but that is not my target. All of the kids that I'll be working with, starting with the United States, and then we have 15 countries who have expressed an interest, including Australia, where we'll build a campus of UBU. We'll take these kids that have been just thrown away. There's no one really out there looking out after them. And we would give them the best education possible. So all of our education is going to be in multimedia. So math, science, history, English will look like a movie. And they'll take an hour class, and then they'll discuss it for an hour. Then they'll spend 2 hours in a multimedia lab to edit the discussion and then tag that to the original classwork. And that immersion will help them really understand and remember what they're learning, rather than the way that I learned was you memorize, you regurgitate, you take a test, and then you forget it. And so I wanted it to be a little more interesting. And then one of the things that I think is going to be very beneficial to these kids is the visiting instructor program, where anyone who has a passion or an expertise will be able to come down, teach a couple of classes, hang out for a week. And the kids will have exposure to things like auto mechanics, professional sports programs, dancing, music, theater, every possible topic there is. And I have a woman who is 79 years old who wants to come down and teach yoga because it's her passion. So we have just incredible things in store for these kids.
Okay. Now that sounds, anything I ask and talk about is basically looking really at things that I've worked with in the UK and seen as, is there a way that you're getting over problems that we couldn't get over, that sort of question. So, I mean, we found that a lot of our people that were coming in, they weren't on the streets or anything. They were people that really, they didn't have a bad life, but they hadn't been very academic at school. Now, do you find that that's a sort of an area which is a difficulty, where you've got youngsters who really just don't really seem good at schoolwork, but then if you give them something which is a hands-on, if you like, they seem to change and take a different interest in the future, don't they?
Well, they do, and my brother was a prime example where I think he never got anything better than a D in math. And I excelled in math. And then when he went through cancer, the California State Employment Division gave him a retraining program, and he chose to go into construction estimating. And I said, you know, my goodness, do you know that that involves math? And he laughed at me, and I said, okay, this is how we're going to do it. And I sat down with him because he loved to cook. And I took a recipe for four and then said that he had to make a dinner with the same recipe for 11 people and showed him how math actually works by something he was interested in. And he was the only person in the class, in the construction estimating class, that got straight A's because it appealed to something that he was interested in. Where a lot of kids, when they're going through school, and I was virtually the same way up until my freshman year in high school, that it felt like I was being forced to learn things that I had no interest in. And I had these amazing teachers. I woke up one day in my freshman year and I said, you know, I have to go to college. My parents can't afford to help me, so what am I going to do? And every teacher said, if you do this book report, if you write an extra paper, if you do, you know, an extra assignment, we'll work with you on your grades. And I had been maybe a C-minus student in my freshman year, and graduated high school at 3.8 and got scholarships to UC Berkeley and California State University, Chico. And it wasn't that I was having learning challenges, it's just that the education process didn't appeal to me. So it was that concept, along with my brother, that gave me the idea that kids really can learn. It doesn't matter their intelligence or their family economics. It just somehow you have to tap into that passion that is laying under the surface. How do you inspire them?
Okay. I take it also this is for boys and girls, isn't it?
It is. I have the property that we're going to be purchasing, it's 5,000 acres, so the boys' campus is 5 miles from the girls' campus. And I don't know if we're going to put up a 30-foot fence between them or what.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now, the next thing that I wanted to ask you about is looking at the Australian interview, which was the Clancy Tucker interview. He was talking about Belize. Now, is that really still the major focus of what you're doing at the moment?
It is, and we're probably within 30 days of going to Belize and breaking ground. So my brother chose Belize because he said it was one of the last spiritual sanctions in the world that had been untouched. And so it's a land where you know, I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the town just north of me is Oakland, and there's 650,000 people there, and it's probably 15 miles square, I would guess. And Belize is 180 miles long and about 60 miles wide, and there's 350,000 people in the entire country. So it's totally different than any environment I've ever been in since I was a kid. And so you can get things done. You can, you know, start a project and have people engaged immediately. So I love the idea of Belize, the temperature, the weather. It's tropical. There's, you know, just so much open space there. And the real reason for me, not to misalign my brother's concept, but I can raise a child, educate them for $15,000 a year, compared to the United States, it's $45,000 a year.
Okay. Now, the obvious thing that is always going to be a big player in anything that's like this is raising the money. And is it a balance between obtaining grants and retaining the integrity of whatever you want to achieve? Is that something that's been a problem, or can you make it always on your own with the financial capital, and although it doesn't come immediately, you can retain totally the control over what you do?
You know, it's an interesting question, Vince, because I've had a lot of people who are very philanthropic. A couple of billionaires said, geez, I'd love to help you. Once you get the school started, we'd be glad to revisit this. And nobody wanted to be the first person, and that's why it's taken me all this time. Then about 2 years ago, I had a person that was a potential client met a broker who's involved with an investor, and they asked for proposals. They had 60,000 proposals. They accepted 120, and mine was one, and they have agreed to provide the funding for the entire project. And so they're starting with $358 million for the construction, and they're willing to do a five-year commitment, which is $85 million a year in operations cost, the construction to build a four-year university on the same campus. It's everything that I could dream of. And that money has been held up because of the global reset, the whole economic reform that is hinging on Iraq, Vietnam, Zimbabwe, and about nine other countries. So they've been told that they can't release the funds until the bonds have been released, until the global reset happens, and so that's what's held me up for the past 2 years. But it was approved 2 years ago.
You see, where I live in Spain, and certainly what's been happening in Europe in general, is that we've come to a situation now where really all the financial systems seem very feeble, very frail. It's almost as though, and if anybody hiccups on the other side of the world, we've got a crisis of the Eurozone or the pound sterling, or, you know, it's very, very difficult to understand. There was something that you were trying to tell me which I really couldn't quite understand. When you were talking about the reset, the global reset, we haven't, not that I'm aware of, I don't think we've had the information that you sent to me before. I mean, I've not seen it in mainstream press, that's for sure. So when you say you were awarded funds, I think in December, who actually awarded the funds to you?
It's an investor, private investor from China, who put money into the platform, which had been created after World War II. And if you leave large sums of money, minimum $10 million, but normally $100 million, the money actually doubles in a year. And the caveat is that you have to spend 80% of the interest, the extra $80 million on $100 million, in philanthropic projects. So that's where his funding is actually coming from. It happens to be in Switzerland, and he opened a bank account in the name of the school, and I don't know where it is, and we've just simply been waiting for the global reset. And normally we would not hear about this. It's not mainstream. It's something that is generally from the central banks, the world banks, our Federal Reserve, which, you know, all of these are privately owned institutions controlling money. And so we wouldn't hear about it because it would be like a family secret of ways of people increasing wealth. But because of the internet, because we have access to information all over the world today, a lot of us became aware of it. There's about 6 million people out of 320 million people in the United States who have been following this faithfully anywhere from, you know, a year to 10 years. A lot of the soldiers who were in Iraq and Afghanistan were told before they left to buy Iraqi dinar, and they've been holding it all this time, some since 1991. And because if you follow the trail of economics, in 1971, the Iraqi dinar was worth $3.72. Today, one U.S. dollar will actually buy you 1,166 dinar. So it's flip-flopped about 3,000%. But Iraq happens to be the wealthiest country gold-backed by the amount of currency that they have. They're second only to China in how much gold they possess. But because of the oil that they have, which is over 2.5 billion barrels of oil, they're producing 2.5 million barrels a day, they have the richest assets of any country in the world. So the fact that their currency isn't even worth one-tenth of a penny for their dinar, that is a little lopsided. So that's one of the reasons why there would be a reset of their currency.
Okay.
The other countries are following the same path.
I mean, all as we can see from our TV screens, and obviously trying to take an intelligent interest in these things, is that, you know, it seems to be always that there's got to be a war and bombs and people, you know, wrecking countries before there's then maybe anything that seems to get back to, I won't say normality, because I don't think the world's been normal since we last spoke. You know, we were speaking in probably 2008, I think you said. I mean, the world has not been a normal place since those days. And you see, who is going to be responsible for this global reset? Because I don't know how anybody can do it at the moment.
Well, it's controlled by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, the UN, the Banking Information System, BIS, the World Bank. And they have all gotten together and they've decided that, you know, this is the time to make this happen. It's only happened in our lifetime one other time before. It was right after World War II. And you remember, back in 1980, I went to England, and I was able to get £2 for a dollar.
Yeah.
Today, I only get, I think it's flipped, like the dollar will only get me 0.64 of a pound.
Yes.
And so if you look at how the currencies have changed, you know, in 20, 30 years, you know, that's part of what the global reset is about. It's writing the countries who have the assets. Like the United States has not backed their currencies by gold since Reagan was president.
Yeah.
And the UN is furious that our Federal Reserve went and printed additional dollar bills last October. And so now they're forcing the United States to start using United Treasury notes, the UTN, which is mandatory gold back. So all of these things come into play, and then it's not meant for the public to know, but until this past year, I don't think I was aware of anything like this on an economic level. But because of the funding being tied into this, I have become extremely well educated in world politics and economics because it directly affects me and the other people who are on the team.
Yeah. Well, I was looking at the fact that you wrote, I've sold, hocked and traded for everything I have of value. I mean, this must be awful for you if you've done that, because, you know, if you're anything like me, I've worked hard all my life. I've put my money, hopefully wisely, to one side. And now I'm not even sure that where we've made money, it's worth what we've worked for, because, you know, we've had devaluations and we've had revaluations. We've had all sorts of the likes of the MPs in Britain who have been found to be fiddling everybody. You've got governments that right around the European Union don't seem to have a clue about what really we're all about. And quite honestly, when we were talking the other night and you were saying that, you know, if you could exchange the dinar and the dong, I think it was you said, then what really I found very difficult is that I was trying on the one hand to see how much of your energy you've got to try and create this wonderful opportunity for these young people. And offset against that, you've got these absolutely greedy capitalists who don't seem to care about anybody. In fact, the only thing they seem to care about is making sure that whatever they've got increases in value, no matter what anybody else has to suffer. That seems to be...
You know, that's a good problem. You know, we've had... greed is one of the oldest sins in the world. And when you look at the people like the Rothschilds who have something like $9,000 trillion, and you think, what in the world are they ever going to do with that money? Because you don't see it out in the world helping poverty, stopping hunger, educating people. You know, so why is it that they're in a position to wreak havoc with other people who are trying to make something happen positively in the world? And there's, you know, there's thousands and thousands of people who have ideas for senior programs and youth programs and sports programs and veterans programs, and they're now being held up because these powers to be have found ways of stopping this revaluation from happening. And when you think about, you know, all the economic changes that have happened in our lifetime, you know, it's not simple anymore. You know, you've seen what happens in England. Like, remember those days in the early 1990s when England was nearly bankrupt? Is that about the right time?
Well, no, the precise years were 1974 when they went to the IMF for the first time. And then they went back in 1976, and they got money from the IMF. The balance of payments was adrift in 1969, so it was by the time that they changed the governments, and that the Labour government was then able to go and see if they could get the money, but then it went back to Conservatives, and then, you know, then we had the inflation, which took it up to 30% inflation, and it was really at the beginning of the 80s that we started to maybe make any sort of sense of things, and then we went and had the miners' strike, which, because obviously, you know, I was at college and I'd studied these sort of things, you know, other people wouldn't realise that it was really a philosophical battle. It wasn't always necessary. In fact, that they're talking about going back and digging the coal again. You know, so over my own lifetime, I've seen so many nonsensical things happen. And even right now, if you look at what was happening last year and the year before, and suddenly Greece's economy was ultra important to everybody. And yet nobody was talking about the fact that Greece has the largest tanker fleet in the world taking oil round to other countries. You know, there's no honesty at all in it. And then you look and see who is trying to actually drive what. And, you know, I think both of us were heading towards a position of, you know, what really is Ebola all about? You know, every year they come out with these mass inoculations for the flu jab, and you see some doctors totally and utterly adamant that you don't need a flu jab, and yet, you know, having said that, half of the population of this country was wiped out at one stage through flu. So, you know, you've got to temper virtually every piece of information with what you see and know to be possibly true, as opposed to what people talk about. And certainly with the likes of Facebook and the other sites that you can read other people's information, it does appear that an awful lot of people say things and they don't really know half of what's going on, which leads me to look again at what you have written, because, you know, I do try and take an intelligent interest in things like the exchange rates and why they happen that way. It seemed to me that China is investing in so many areas that suddenly, you know, America's going to wake up and think, hang on, China's everywhere. Why haven't we got ourselves right? And then, of course, you see that the American dollar hasn't got the strength. In fact, it was only 2 days ago I was reading somebody prophesying that the American dollar will go down and it'll be overtaken by the Chinese currency. And, you know, there is evidence that there are possibilities of those sort of things happening. So
China has actually vowed that they will put an end to the petrodollar, and currently the U.S. dollar is worth 84 cents internationally. And once this global reset happens, which is one of the reasons why it's been delayed so often, is their concern that the dollar is going to drop to about 55 cents. And, you know, we have an enormous population who is on welfare and some kind of support from the government, and they're barely able to get by, you know, have food even. And what's going to happen if half of their income is taken away? So, you know, this is one of the reasons why it's been such a juggling act for our government to try to figure out how to second guess what can happen. And, you know, China and Russia, you know about the BRICS. It's, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South America. They're actually just deciding that, Indonesia, I believe, they're going to be launching a new world bank system. And they have over $300 billion, and they're going to do what they can to eliminate the world banks and privately owned banks and make them answerable to a larger government.
But I was reading back in the 1980s that realistically capitalism will ultimately defeat itself. Now, you know, with any views about things like that, you were always accused of being a Marxist. But I think it seems to be a realist because, you know, the ultimate aim of capital is to make capital. And if you watch the TV and listen to the business programs, etc., it would seem that so many people advocate just doing business and making profits, and it doesn't really matter what happens to anybody else whatsoever. So, you know, you get to a point in your life and you start reappraising, and I'm thinking to myself, well, hang on, we always used to have the capitalist system, and on the other side of the fence you had this you know the likes of the communist society where people planned the economy totally. And, you know, when you actually look and see then where dictatorships have been in play, and once the dictators seem to have gone, you seem to have all these other problems. And of course there are so many problems in the world at the moment that I don't think people anywhere have really got a clue which currency can be the strongest. And if it wasn't for the American army, who were prepared to actually do something, I say the army, I mean, you know, all the forces, if it wasn't for the American presence in the world, it's almost like, you know, the current problem of this Islamic State fanatical people, you know, they'd be running amok and nobody would do much about it. So at least it would appear to me that if we still have a strong America, we've got a chance to try and fight these things. Whereas, you know, it seems that so many people spend so much energy trying to just defeat America. I really, really can't get my head around that one.
Well, everybody wants somebody else to be the bad guy. And right now, the United States, because I think we're looked at as being like a John Wayne movie. You know, you go in, you push your way through a country, you make things happen because you think you're doing right. But maybe that country needs to stand up and fight for itself. Maybe they don't have the resources, and that's why the United States shows up. Maybe the United States is there backed by the UN because the United States is known for having that kind of an attitude, but then the United States gets their foothold in economically in that country. So, you know, there's all these things that happen in the background, and literally until this past year, I had no clue how extremely complicated these things happen to be. And when we hear of something on the news, it's generally something, although it seems like it just happened, but it really happened 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Or maybe we only hear a little portion of it, and we're not ever meant to know the whole story.
I think you're right. I think a lot of the news is sanitized. Because I live in Spain, because I now can think in Spanish, I'm not totally fluent, but I'm not bad. I do watch the Spanish news, and I see that things that are shown on the Spanish television to the Spanish people here are not the same priorities, certainly, that the English people are shown on British TV, which we do have here as well. I mean, what really I'm trying to come to sort of a point of view in my own mind is, how can anybody, not meaning any one person, but how can people best help you? Because really, your project seems to be hinging on what the political and the socio-political dealings of the world seem to be, you know, whatever way that pans out, will be either to your benefit or to you, not to your benefit. Would that be the right way to look at it?
You're right. It is. And that's what's made it so frustrating, is that there's a country 7,000 miles from where I live who every act they take, every decision they make, affects me and the beginning of 6,000 children who are living on the streets and this winter have no place to go to protect them from the elements. So it is extremely difficult to deal with this as a mindset that my life is controlled by politics and economics that have nothing to do with me or the United States, and yet everything to do with me and the United States.
I think this is why I live in Spain now, because, you know, I came to a point in UK where, you know, you do your bit, you try and you try to use your integrity, you try to act honestly. And all around you see things that people at all levels are doing which shouldn't really be being done. Let me just ask you, Sharon, you asked me if I know Rafa Pal. I went to the internet and I looked at him. And yes, I think he looks very interesting. I'll try and, you know, he was speaking very fast, so I'll have to sit down and study that. But you were looking to see if I've got any banking contacts from which we could find out about, you know, whether these things might be true that you are getting information about. Well, I've sent a message to a friend, a fellow broadcaster, who might be able to help. Our difficulty in Spain is knowing who on earth we can trust, because I mean, really, the Spanish banking is certainly no better than the English banking. And English banking has been totally and utterly discredited over the previous few years. So, you know, I'd be loath to give you a contact who I thought might not give you the right information or might want to, in some way or another, impede your work. So I've only really got one person in mind that when we come off this podcast, I'll try and get the contact for you. But if there's somebody listening into our podcast, if I can encapsulate what we've spoken about, really, you've been inspired by your brother who sadly, you know, has now got a legacy that you want to try and help young kids who are not really the kids who have got the best chances in life, and you're trying to help them in an educational sense that's a bit different. You're trying to inspire them to get off the wrong road and get back on the beaten track and get themselves as useful members of society by going to a special educational place that you've got in Belize, but you can't get the money to actually get this really properly running until the world situation is sorted out. Would that be a fair analysis of what's happened?
It definitely is. You've done that well.
Okay, so if anybody is listening in, because obviously I'll be putting this out on the internet, if anybody might just be maybe a benefactor that's looking for something that they could help with, or maybe know somebody that would feel as passionate as you obviously do, because you've given up so much to try and get this going, what would they best be doing to help you? What would you like them to do?
Well, obviously, if they can help with the funding initially, just so we can get started, that would be wonderful. But we're looking for teachers. We're looking for experts in every possible venue. We're going to be looking for, you know, 6,000 pairs of tennis shoes and T-shirts and, you know, beds and everything you could imagine to, you know, take care of these kids.
So would these people be volunteers who would go to Belize and would work with you in Belize?
Well, I do have full-time positions. The school will actually have 5,700 employees. There will be, I'm going to say, 50% of those employees will be residents of Belize. They have a 13.5% unemployment rate. And the rest, we want to bring in international. We want people who have a wide variety of experience that we can pass on to these kids.
And would it be any use maybe approaching the universities in the United Kingdom and maybe Spain, but certainly those are the two countries that would spring to mind, to maybe see whether any educational programs could possibly offer students who might want to come out and do some sort of period of 6, 7, or 8 weeks, 3 months, or whatever it would be, to gain experience abroad, but to give you also what you need?
Well, we will have an exchange program, definitely. I'm trying to make it possible for any of the students who want to do university at sea. I just think the world experiences are invaluable. And I am seeing people who take advantage of being able to do these kinds of exchange programs, and it changes their lives. You know, so I'm a big fan of that.
Okay. Right. So what about a contact detail or the best way for somebody to get in touch with you, the email and the website and that sort of thing? Could you give that information out?
Absolutely. My email is Sharon@ultimatebusinessuniv.com. It's ultimatebusinessuniv.com. My phone number in the Bay Area is 510-467-3402. And the website, of course, ultimatebusinessuniv.com. And you know, any ideas, any connections, I am wide open. I have met some amazing people around the world, including yourself, you know, and you know I keep in touch with people. I love building relationships.
Right. Look, what I should do now then, I'll try and get this podcast out tonight. If not, it'll be out tomorrow. We'll have a web page which I'll put some links on. And I'll send you the link of what I've done. And then, obviously, I've written to the person I have in mind. I hope he agrees to have a chat with you, because I think he might have far more expertise in the finance world than I have. and he might well be a good contact for you. So I have asked the question, and the minute I've got an answer, I'll come back and let you know.
Okay, that's wonderful.
All right, Sharon. And in the meantime, I wish you all the very best, and I'll put this out, and we'll have this podcast going out over all my connections over the next few weeks.
I really appreciate it, Vince. It's been fun.
All right, Sharon. It's lovely to talk to you again. And obviously, I wish you well in your project.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Sharon. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.